The newspaper life, as depicted in plays like The Front Page and Even All the President's Men, is a workaday world of hard-drinking, wise-cracking reporters, most of them male. But those times may be changing, albeit slowly. My guest Kay Mills has written a new book that tells how women are moving into the newspaper business in ever greater numbers. Mills' book is titled A Place in the News, From the Women's Page to the Front Page. In it, she points out that though great progress has been made over the past 20 years, the career path for women in newspapers has been fraught with discrimination, insults, and hazing. Mills' anecdotal and thoughtful account was drawn from the experiences of the 150 reporters and editors she interviewed. Kay Mills began her career in journalism 20 years ago at United Press International, and she now writes editorials for the Los Angeles Times. Kay Mills took a leave of absence from her job at the Times to write A Place in the News because she couldn't find a book that told this story on the shelves.
First of all, I taught a course several years ago at the University of Southern California on women in the media, and I realized there was no book. I'd always wanted to write a book, and it seemed like two and two made four in that case. When you were teaching a course like this, all you had was magazine articles, and it seemed to me students believe things more when they're in books. So that was one reason. I'm sounding a little facetious, but actually I think my higher motive was that I thought young people, young men and young women going into the profession ought to know more about it, ought to know more about the lawsuits and the pioneers and that sort of thing. And it's not like we want to sound like, you know, I walked 4 miles through the snow to school every day, but I thought they needed to know something about the profession. And I guess the other reason that I wrote the book was I was hoping it might change some things, that some people at the top might read it, might see the wisdom of what I'd written, and promote some more women into some of the top jobs.
You make an interesting point. You say that newspapers define what news is by the fact that it appears in the papers, and that you see women getting work in newspapers as a way of getting more women in newspapers.
Mm-hmm. It really is connected. I mean, I think women who are reporters are not necessarily any better reporters than men. I mean, we cover fires the same way. We cover prison breaks the same way. But I do think everybody hears different things. Blacks hear different things. Latinos hear different things. Asian Americans, Native Americans, women. So I think what happens is you know more about what one segment of the community is interested in, whether it's children, women's health problems or something. So with more women there, they finally realized they could speak up and say, hey, you know, politics isn't the only thing that news, or if it is, women in politics are part of that story too.
How powerful an instrument of change do you see newspapers?
Oh, probably not as much as they used to be. I mean, certainly television has had such an enormous impact. But I think newspapers, certainly the serious ones, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the Washington Post, the Philadelphia Inquirer, whatever, the serious ones still are the agenda that what's in the paper that day is what the radio and TV shows also show. So I think we definitely still help shape the agenda.
It's true. You can go through network newsrooms and see reporters tearing out stories from the New York Times and the Los Angeles
absolutely.
Times, getting their story ideas for the evening news.
Yeah, it's the ripple effect. We do some of that. I mean, there's feedback. The ripple sometimes washes back into the newspaper newsroom. If TV is making a big deal out of something, then we start making a big deal. I mean, we all sort of work in the same pond, to continue that awful metaphor. But I think newspapers still, particularly the good ones, have a profound influence on what people think, particularly the decision makers. That's why I guess I think it's so important that women be part of the decision-making team at newspapers.
What attracted you to the newspaper business, and were there many women in it when you started?
There were not many women, no. I worked on my junior high school paper in Bethesda, Maryland. I worked on my high school paper. I worked on my college paper at Penn State. I was sort of single-minded. I guess maybe what attracted me was the chance to be nosy and get paid for it. the chance to write. That was really what it was. I liked to write. I wasn't into writing fiction or poetry. As one of the women that I interviewed said, she didn't fancy sitting in the attic wearing a cameo and being Emily Dickinson. She wanted to get out in the world, and I guess that's a bit of what attracted me. I had an uncle who was a copy editor for the Roanoke Times years ago, and he didn't have to go to work until 2:30 in the afternoon. I thought that sounded really neat.
What time do you have to be at work now?
Well, I go in very early to beat the traffic in Los Angeles, so I'm at work by about 7:30 or 7:45. I'm not a night person anymore, but that at the time when I was about 7 years old, it seemed really neat that he could sleep until 11 o'clock in the morning. I thought that was the greatest thing. And also, any time I was visiting there, if there was a fire, we could call up my uncle and find out where the fire was. Boy, that was, you know, we knew something before other people did. So I guess that was what planted the seed. Then when I started, it's interesting, you know, the first woman that I ever worked for was the editor of my college paper at Penn State. It was also the last woman I ever worked for. Interesting commentary on our times. But when I started, which was with United Press International in Chicago in 1964, I guess it was, there were several women there. There still were some barriers to break down. They didn't want to work the overnight from midnight to 8 because they said it wasn't safe. I pointed out to them that we went home at midnight, and that, you know, so why not come in at midnight and we can make more money? Well, that seemed to make sense. So UPI was actually pretty good about women. We have a joke there that it was an equal opportunity employer. It treated everyone poorly. When I went to work in Baltimore, I was only the second woman ever in the newsroom since World War II. And the first one, fortunately, had been good, so it was okay to hire me. So I have seen enormous changes in the business in that 20, 25 years.
You quote Pat Morrison of the Los Angeles Times telling a joke, saying that she became a journalist because she wanted to see men type.
Right. It's a great leveler, and I never really thought of it that way. You can always count on Pat for some good lines. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that, because when I talk about a place in the news, I tend to get sort of serious and talk about what women can contribute to the newspapers, the need for women to be at the top. But as I was thinking about it on the way in today, I realized there are a lot of funny stories in the book, too, you know. There are a lot of stories that I think people, men and women, would identify with. Dale Mezzacapa of the Philadelphia Inquirer took her little boy to the National Organization for Women convention a couple years ago. And she tells a very funny story about trying to finish up her work after the daycare part of the convention had ended and trying to write the story, trying to interview Ellie Smeal. The whole Now hierarchy was babysitting for Matthew while she was interviewing Ellie Smeal. And then she couldn't finish the story before she had a plane to catch, trying to file the story in the Atlanta airport with Matthew, whose diaper badly needed changing, wandering off. I mean, you know, they're just some moments that everybody would identify with in the book, or things that Molly Ivins of the Dallas Times-Herald said. Molly is a very funny woman, and she told some very funny stories in the book, and I think it's not all heavy stuff, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
My guest is Kay Mills. She's an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times and author of the new book, A Place in the News, From the Women's Pages to the Front Pages. Part of the difficulty of getting women from the women's pages to the front pages as correspondents, as reporters, has been the sort of the clubbiness of male reporters. And one of the most startling stories in your book is that of the National Press Club, which did not allow women until 1971. But one of the I was interested to see that Nikita Khrushchev had an important role in trying to bring about the end of discrimination at the National Press Club, that august body in Washington, D.C.
Yes, that story has surprised a lot of people because they tend to think of the press as sort of an egalitarian body. But the National Press Club did not vote to admit women until 1971. There was a big campaign that was mounted to try to change that. Helen Thomas, who's the senior White House correspondent now, was one of the principal movers in that. And the problem was that, I mean, you think, so what, a club, who cares? But the problem was that leading national and international figures came and spoke to the National Press Club if they spoke nowhere else. And if you couldn't cover that, if you weren't a member, you couldn't get in, you couldn't do your job. Now, granted, there were not as many women in the press corps then either. Press Club finally relented and let women sit in the balcony. But what that meant was that people like Helen Thomas were farther from the telephone, couldn't get a speech text if there was one, couldn't ask questions. So they were at a competitive disadvantage with, in Helen's case, with the Associated Press. So they went on this campaign to try to get foreign visitors not to speak at the press club. And one of the ones who said no, he wouldn't speak there unless the women could come, was Nikita Khrushchev, which, of course, raised great consternation at the State Department and among the male members of the press club. So they relented in that one case and let women in. And then slowly, gradually, they let women have tables on the main floor, then they let them ask questions, then finally they realized that they were in danger of becoming the men's press club if they didn't admit women, and they voted. There were, by that time, a number of men who thought this whole thing was silly and that women should be members, and they voted overwhelmingly to let women in. Why they had wanted to keep them out for so many years, the only thing I can figure is that they wanted their bar sacred so that they could get away from home and go sit and drink in peace. I don't know. It all seemed rather silly to me. I do remember one summer when I was working for UPI in Washington while I was in college. I had to sit in the balcony when covering an event, and it's a sobering experience.
16 years have passed since the National Press Club then has admitted
right,
women.
Right, exactly.
What
and
about...
They have merged with what used to be the Women's National Press Club. So there is now one press club, and there have been several women who have been presidents of the National Press Club, by the way.
What changes have you seen amongst women reporters since that time? Are women and men reporters able to work on the campaign trail as well together? Are women in newspaper management now in analogous positions to men? Has there been that much progress in 16 years?
There's been a lot of progress. There's never enough progress, you know. Certainly, this political campaign, you look at the front page of the New York Times, you look at the front page of the Los Angeles Times, you see women's bylines on the campaign trail. Still don't see too many women writing the election night lead, the convention lead when Michael Dukakis or George Bush gets the nomination. The big boys still do the big stories. But that's changing. That's breaking down. There are a number of women. There are 8 women now who are editors of newspapers. Catherine Fanning at the Christian Science Monitor, Janet Chusmere, at the Miami Herald. We have 2 in California, 1 at the Fresno Bee, 1 at the Riverside Press Enterprise, but that's 8 out of something on the order of 1,700 newspapers. So, there are more editors of smaller newspapers, but it's still something on the order of 12 or 13% of the senior editors at newspapers are women, where the workforce is about a third women. So that's a little out of sync yet.
How much of this is a function of age? I ask because a friend of mine is a reporter for a newspaper. She's in her, late 20s, and mm-hmm. she finds that the people who are leaving newspaper buildings tend to be these sort of world-weary men in their 50s and 60s, and that she hopes that eventually, you know, as they move on into retirement, mm-hmm. there'll be more openings for women, and that it's a matter of time in this regard. Is this a realistic assessment of what's going on in the newspaper business?
Oh, I think your friend's absolutely right. Certainly, the generation that's now in charge of newspapers is almost exclusively white male. As they retire, there are slowly some openings. There are a number of women in middle management now, trained and ready to move up. I think if time were the answer alone, though, we would have more women in top jobs. I mean, there have been some major legal actions. The New York Times was sued. The Associated Press was sued for sex discrimination. Both those cases were settled out of court, but they opened some doors for women. I think that what's still needed is more commitment at the top. If a publisher, if an editor really believes in advancing women, and I might add minorities, then I think more will happen faster. If we wait for time alone to change this and bring your friend into a management job, I'm afraid we're all going to be sitting around at the old feminist home before that happens. So it needs a nudge, is what I'm saying.
Well, the Washington Post had a publisher, Catherine Graham, the New York Post, publisher Dorothy Schiff. What was the policy at those papers when, as they were publishers, toward hiring women as both reporters and in management? Or did it make a difference?
Well, I think Dorothy Schiff made a difference. She put, I'm cite in a place in the news, the case of Judy Michelson, who was a reporter and actually a secretary for the editor. And Dorothy Schiff saw a couple of stories she'd done on sort of a tryout basis, I guess. And she helped make her a political reporter. So I think she made a difference. Certainly Helen Reed at the New York Herald Tribune years ago made sure Maggie Higgins went overseas, and Maggie Higgins went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for her coverage in Korea, and she brought Irina Van Doren in as the book editor and brought Dorothy Thompson in as one of the first syndicated political columnists.
Were these extraordinary moves on their part? Or it sounds like
they were
kind of rare.
They were, and I think you have to bear in mind that the women at the Washington Post filed an equal employment opportunity complaint while Catherine Graham was publisher. So while she was good in some cases, you know, it was still some of the guys that were running the national section and the foreign section and the metro section that were not doing as well by women as the women felt they could be.
My guest is journalist Kay Mills. She's just written a new history of women newspaper reporters titled A Place in the News. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Kay Mills. She's an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times, and she's written a new book that looks at the recent rise of women going into the newspaper business. It's titled A Place in the News. Are there any places where women are at a disadvantage as reporters?
I think in some cases, some women may still be at a disadvantage as sports reporters. They've really had some of the last barriers to break down the old locker room thing. And that has broken down in places where women are sports reporters. But as one of them said to me, every time in a smaller paper a new woman is assigned to the sports beat, she has to go through the same thing of some hazing in the locker room, some question as to whether she knows sports well enough. I mean, it's all rather silly because women have been sports fans for a long time. You look at a game, you go to a Dodger game, and you look around the stadium, there are a lot of women there, and they're yelling just as loud as the men. They know just as much, and they weren't dragged there by force. So I think that's one place where certainly they're still having to prove themselves. I'm not sure they're at a disadvantage. I think women can pretty much do as much as men. If they're at a disadvantage, it is sort of in the men's eyes, or sometimes we defeat ourselves a little bit. We're not sure we can do it. And you really do have to tell some of the young women not to let the cops bother you when, you know, they think you can't do the job or you're too young or something. Just work on through it, you know.
What about what's going on in locker rooms? athletes like to parade around nude. You talk about Reggie Jackson doing that a lot.
Right, yeah.
In part to intimidate the women coming in.
I think so. And I think that's changing as they get more and more used to it. And certainly in the sports where the players have been to college and had a little more sophistication, and that's maybe a word that's a little strong to use. But, I mean, they've had a brush with classes, as one of the sports writers told me, and they're certainly better. The basketball players, generally speaking, don't seem to have any problem with women in the locker rooms, and even a lot of the football players. So that's changing. But each place, there's a new woman. There's a certain amount of hazing of any new reporter on a beat. police beat. They like to show you a dead body. You know, they just want to see if you can do it. Mm-hmm. And once mm-hmm. you work through it, Helene Elliott of Newsday told me just a very funny story of how she handles the players in the locker room. She was covering the New York Rangers hockey team. And one of the players' wives asked her, don't you look? You know, and she said, no, she said, I have a job to do. And she said, I can tell you that I know the color of every player's eyes. And so when she was in the locker room, the next time one of the players came up to her and closed his eyes and put his hands over the eyes of the two players on either side of him and said, okay, Helene, prove it. And I said, well, could you? She said, didn't I have to? So you deal with it in various different ways, but I think it is changing. I hope so.
And did she know the colors of those eyes?
She did. She did. She proved it. Believe me, she proved it.
Foreign correspondents have always been a way to the front page. And in many times, women have turned down some of these assignments out of fear or dislike of spending a lot of time in South American hotels for months on end. Mm-hmm. But others have chosen to go. What is going on in a reporter's mind when she is making that kind of a choice? You've talked to, 150 reporters all told?
Right. And a number of them were foreign correspondents. I think, obviously, the single people, male or female, actually, find it easier to go. It is getting increasingly hard at newspapers to get some of the young men who are married to go because their wives work. It's interesting, the Washington Post, just to insert parenthetically, the Washington Post now has a married couple sharing the Tokyo assignment. And I think that's an interesting development that's worth watching and that more papers may consider. I think there are just some of us who are drawn to adventure, and there are some who are not. And certainly, the interesting thing is that Latin America used to be the backwater that, if you felt you had to send a woman somewhere, you sent her to Latin America. And now it's a big story, and there are women all over the place who are experts in Nicaragua and El Salvador. And Abe Rosenthal, who's the former editor of the New York Times, told me when I was talking to him for my book, he said, you know, I went to Salvador to try to hire several correspondents. He said, I'm used to being in war zones. I've been to Beirut and the Congo and so forth. And whenever you arrive in one of these places, you go to the hotel and you find the correspondents, the swapping stories. And he said, in Salvador, a number of them were women. And he said, there were three or four of them that I would have hired if I could. And he did hire Shirley Christian, who now covers Buenos Aires for the New York Times. So it's interesting that what used to be a backwater has now developed into a story, and women have benefited from it.
You took a leave of absence from your job at the Los Angeles Times to write this book, and you're fairly critical of the Los Angeles Times and their policy. Have you gone back to work at the Los Angeles Times now?
I have been back writing editorials since Labor Day of last year, so almost a year, yes.
So what was the reaction? Have you been able to bring about some change at the Times?
Well, not yet. A little frustrating, but I've gotten, I got a very nice note from the publisher of the paper, Tom Johnson, saying that he had looked over the book very carefully, thought it was important and well done, and that he knew that the Times needed to do better, and we would do better. I keep needling him about delivering, you know. But certainly the reaction among my colleagues is very favorable. They, in fact, think I perhaps should have been a little harsher on the paper. I'm generally speaking, we're waiting. We have a new editor, Shelby Coffey, and we're waiting to see what happens.
You work as an editorial writer for the Los Angeles Times. Does this mean that your work appears for the most part without a byline?
That's right. Sometimes I feel very anonymous. I combat that fear of anonymity, if you will, by writing some profiles about half a dozen times a year with Westerners, particularly Californians, who have interesting ideas. Mm-hmm. So I get a byline occasionally because, after all, I think journalists have an ego or we wouldn't have gone into the business. So that's how I combat it. But yes, for the most part, I write things that are the Los Angeles Times opinion, so I don't have a byline.
You quote Karen Elliott House of the Wall Street Journal as saying, "I think women may have become conservative with success. Mm-hmm. When you have nothing to lose, you're willing to risk more." Do you feel that you're at that point in the career that you've become conservative with your success as an editorial writer? What are you willing to risk?
Well, you know, I asked a colleague of that of mine that just the other day when I was thinking about needling something, somebody about something, and I said, it was sort of the flip side. Am I in danger of sounding off too much? She said, you can't sound off too much. Don't be conservative. And so that does enter my mind. I don't think so. My general sense is that for writing this book, still being at the L.A. Times and criticizing the L.A. Times, I'm not sure that's terribly conservative. They've been very good about it, but I think I stepped on some toes. And if that's conservative, so be it.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and talking to us about the history of women in newspapers.
Well, I appreciate the time very much. Thank you.
Kay Mills' new history on women in newspapers is titled A Place in the News, From the Women's Pages to the Front Page. It's published by Dodd Mead. I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air.